Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
This is not a diving podcast, but Scuba.
Welcome to the show. I'm Scuba. This is the Not a Diving Podcast. Right, got to say thank you for all the great feedback to last week's episode with Trevor Jackson. That was one of the best episodes, or one of my favourite episodes anyway, I think, that we've done so far. Lots of you thought so too, and have sent me lots of messages saying so. So yeah, thank you for that. I'm glad you enjoyed it. I'm glad that, yeah, you got so much out of that. It was a really interesting conversation with Trevor. We covered quite a lot of different stuff, but I made sure to leave some subjects undiscussed. So there's room for another one with Trevor some point down the line. So yeah, really good one. Really good one. Okay, on the show this week, we have none other than Speedy J. You would have noticed that from the title of this post, or the title of the podcast in your podcast client, which you may be using. So yes, BDJ, just a really important producer in the history of techno. I mean, he really is. Like, we're talking about a couple of things mostly in this conversation. It's a bit shorter than usual, but over an hour anyway, so we get pretty deep into some stuff. But two things in particular. First of all, his Stour project, which he's doing nowadays, which is a improvisational performance project primarily, or at least that's where it's mostly inhabiting in the real world. It kind of started, well, it sort of first came into being in the public consciousness as a series of live jams during the pandemic based out of his studio in Rotterdam. And his studio sounds pretty amazing. That's what we talk about initially. But it has subsequently become a thing that they do at various parties around the world, most notably at ADE, where they've done for the last couple of years a couple of really big shows each year. I'll put a link in the show notes to the YouTube footage of those parties, because the whole thing's streamed, all 7 hours or so of it. And it's, yeah, a collaborative live jam, basically. It's sort of reminiscent of what we talked about with Sebastian Mellart at his Circle of Life thing back on episodes, I've no idea what it was, 60-something, I think, or maybe 50-something. But yeah, the principles are kind of similar, but it's a slightly different approach, subtly different approach. But yeah, Speedy J is the guy who's developed it and is kind of leading it. And it's just a pretty cool thing, really, as you'll notice from the YouTube footage. So yeah, we talk about that. And then we talk about, most importantly, for me anyway, most crucially, his album Ginger, which came out as part of the Artificial Intelligence series on Warp in the early 90s. Now, artificial intelligence was just crucial, I think, for the development of everything, really, of this kind of music. It really, really was. It was a series of albums by people like Ortega, Aphex Twin as Polygon Window, Richie Horton as Fuse, and a few others. I'll link to the full list in the show notes as well. But it was basically what gave birth to the IDM genre. And that's obviously a genre which became slightly maligned subsequently. But I mean, that series of albums is just incredible. And if you're not familiar with it, then 100% go and check it out right now. So the Speedy J contribution was this album called Ginger, and it's the 30th anniversary of it. So we talk a lot about that too, which was really great for my 14-year-old or 15-year-old self to be able to dig into that album with him. So yeah, that's what we're talking about this week. Before we do that, a reminder that you can support the show. We've been doing a pledge drive, but that's over now. So I'm afraid you missed a chance to get a free t-shirt, but fret not. You can still sign up if you are enjoying the show, if you're getting a lot out of it, then we'd be very, very grateful if you saw it in the kindness of your hearts to support us, either on Patreon at patreon.com/scubaofficial or via a one-off donation, which people do via scubaofficial.io/support. So yeah, that would be great if you did that. If you don't want it, if you can't afford it, that's also cool. Follow the show wherever you're listening to this podcast. Hit the follow button, hit the 5-star button on the review thing, and leave us a review as well. That'd be good, wouldn't it? An actual review, a gushing review about how great the Not a Diving podcast is. Also, you can follow the Spotify playlist. There's a link in the show notes to that playlist, which contains lots of great music, as well as all the episodes, lots of great Speedy J tunes in the update this week, but contains all the previous updates too. So there's an absolute ton of stuff in there corresponding to each of the episodes. So yeah, there's a link in the show notes to the playlist. Hit the follow button on that playlist. And join us in the Discord. Hotflushrecordings.com/Discord. There's a great bunch of people in there discussing the show and other things as well, really. So yeah, like I said, it's a great community and we'd love to have you there. So once again, hotflushrecordings.com/Discord is the invite to get into that server. Okay, right. Without further delay, here is Speedy J. Speedy J, welcome to the show. How are you doing?
I'm good, thanks. How are you?
Yeah, I'm okay. I'm not too bad. I actually got a bit of a cold, as you may be able to hear, but I'm just about doing all right.
Well, you sound fine.
Okay, that's good. That's good. Where are you at the moment?
I just built a little microphone setup in the studio. Haven't used the microphone for a while, but so I had to make a connection. But yeah, it seems to work.
Okay. So this is your studio in Rotterdam, I take it?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So I wanted to kick off by talking about the Stoer project. Is that the right pronunciation, actually? Just to establish that.
Yeah, Store.
Store, right, okay.
Yeah.
So I've actually just been watching one of the performances from ADE. I had it on all morning, actually. It's fucking great, man. It really is. Like, it's so cool.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah, tell me about the whole thing, because, I mean, having read up on it a bit, started in 2018, is that right?
Well, yes, that's the year when I got when I moved into the bunker where I am now, because that was something that I was after for a long time before I actually found the space. I wanted to have a place where I would be able to build a studio and other people would be there too, like, you know, other musicians, DJs, and graphic designers, blah blah blah, you know, just people that are on the same kind of mindset, and not really to hang out and do, you know, play PlayStation or whatever, but just to, you know, run into folks that are doing something that is along the lines of what I'm doing, and just as an environment that is fruitful and interesting. I don't mind working by myself, but yeah, I just like places where there's some sort of buzz, you know what I mean? So I moved into this bunker. I found it. It's right in the center of my hometown, Rotterdam. And basically started to set it up as my studio, as well as a facility for collaboration, all sorts of collaborations. The first thing I started out doing was invite people and just collaborate with a focus on live recording, so live music, because that's something that I've always appreciated. I guess it's a lazy and fast way to get results very quickly. I'm not right. The type of person to sit on things for ages and ages, you know, tweaking minor details that nobody but you can hear, you know. So I'd rather get the idea down quickly, even though there are there might be mistakes in it, you know, I'll just move on to the next thing. Anyway, so
let me interrupt you there. I also wanted to ask about the space itself. Like, you know, one of the things which has been, well, one of the, I guess, the big trends in, I guess, all big cities, really, or, you know, any big town, is that it's difficult to find somewhere affordable to do that kind of thing. So, I mean, how big is it to start with?
Well, the whole facility is about 500 square meters, but it's split up in several rooms, and that's basically the natural layout. So there's one big bunker, which is the room I'm occupying, and it's an actual nuclear fallout shelter built in the
Really?
Yeah, like early 50s, I guess.
Wow. Okay. And so, what was it being used for before you got hold of it?
A bunker.
I mean, it was literally that, really.
Yeah, wow. Yeah, and then it's been used for storage for a while. It's been it's underneath a former government building,
right?
Which was vacant for ages. You know, like it's a bit of a hidden place. Just it's right downtown, but not one of the main streets. You kind of have to know where it is. Hmm. But anyway, so it's a nice. It has a natural layout, you know, reinforced walls, so you can make as much noise as you like. It's perfect for studios.
Yeah, amazing.
I don't know what it is, but I'm still my fire starts to burn when I see like a concrete bunker with neon light and all that stuff, you know. Yeah. It's like the early rave vibe, I guess, and that's the vibe that is still here. It's like just a found space, very raw. There's no sound, no fancy sound proofing or anything. It's just all found materials from other floors in the building, sort of repurposed for the goal. And bit by bit, you know, just by moving things around and tweaking the room and the position of things, ended up with a place that's very productive, sounds great, and just has a very inviting vibe to roll up your sleeves and get something going. So that's the result of moving into this, so I started to invite people to collaborate, friends, and it was no real curation going on. It was just fun. Hey, would you like to swing by and record for a few days and see what happens? And in the first stage of the project, we would just record for 2 days and then find the gems in the recordings on day three, basically, and just do some quick mixing and editing. Sometimes not even that, but then just cut it on vinyl with an in-house lathe here. And then
you got a lathe there as well.
Yeah, nice. Yeah. There's a room dedicated to vinyl cutting. They're basically dub plates, so they're being cut one by one by Fritz, our vinyl cutting guy. We basically put them in sort of like archival envelope type sleeves, hand numbered by hand, and it looks like an archive, which it actually is, because I saw the place as something where things happen and it needed to be documented, you know. So instead of take the label approach and accumulate music and then pick a date in the future and have a whole promo campaign leading up to that date and then having this one shot on social media or in the press to get it out, you know. I took the reverse approach and just, you know, put it on Bandcamp whenever it was ready without any announcements, and then, you know, the first people who were lucky to find it bought the vinyl, and when they were gone, you know, and that gave like this.
Right.
So it's sort of, instead of having one release, it was like a continuous album that kind of unfolded by this, every time there was this edition added to the collection. And it's the whole series kind of formed the project, you know, formed the album. And that's basically how it went. And then basically, we were hit with the pandemic. And because
hang on a sec. Did you have that vision from the start? Like, did you know exactly what you wanted to do, you know, when as soon as you got hold of this, the space to do it in? Because, I mean, it's a pretty cool conceptual thing, that, actually. So, like, how did that form in your mind?
Well, the thing is, when you have the space, you know, when there is a space and you have the room and you form this sort of network of people who have all have their special skills, you know, like designers, social media people, video people, vinyl cutting guy, you know, like all these people who are sort of doing their thing in this building, you know, things are going to happen. And I haven't planned exactly what was meant to happen, but I just knew that if I would create the circumstances like that, then things would happen. And yeah, that's what happened.
Yeah,
awesome. And they did start happening. So yeah, because I had this facility during COVID, everybody was sitting at home. But the first weekend, basically on Thursday, the gig started to be cancelled, and on Saturday we had the first stay home sound system live stream, complete with logo, camera setup, and a lineup. And
right.
And that, yeah. because the facility was there, you know, we were already here, and
sure.
And slowly but surely this sort of formed into a series where I invited a person every Sunday to the studio, basically telling them on WhatsApp, you know, like, hey, would you like to jam on Sunday? Do you have, you know, do you have anything to do, any plans? And then they would just bring some gear. And we would set it up, basically sound check it for about, you know, I don't know, an hour or so, and then make sure everything synced up. And then we would hit the streaming computer and just go live on air. And we did that for almost a year and a half during COVID. There's 42 episodes in total. And that created some kind of following, you know, that people... We basically opened up the bunker, the lab, to, you know, for people to be a fly on the wall to see people jamming in the studio, and that, yeah, basically everybody said, well, if the clubs are back open again, are you going to do this in some sort of version on stage, you know? So that's where the Store Live is coming from, that you're referring to in the beginning.
Yeah, absolutely. So when you were doing it on the streams, how long would you jam for?
Until we felt it was enough. There was no time slot, there was no format, you know. It was basically, I mean, you know, we've all seen these DJ sets in empty clubs, you know, without audiences. And to me, that just underlined the sadness of the whole thing, you know. So basically, this was the complete opposite. It was like trying to create like a sort of homey, intimate atmosphere with people having fun, making music together. And then just give the audience a little bit of an opportunity to have a peek into that situation. You know, it was never meant to be a dance floor session, you know. There were sessions that were absolutely banging, but there were also ones that were just you know, experimenting with noises and anything, you know, like whatever we felt like doing. And I must say, when the necessity of being functional with your music disappears, all kinds of other avenues open up. Also for the people that I was jamming with, you know, they saw it as an opportunity to do something they've always, you know, tried to do, or, you know, but never really got the chance to do, or whatever. So, you know, so it gave some freedom and opportunity for that as well. So
I had Sebastian Mellart on to talk about his Circle of Life thing, which is there's some similarities, I think, between what you guys are doing and the kind of...
Oh, for sure, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, I mean, it was really interesting to talk with him about how, you know, improvisation kind of works in his mind, and how, and in practical terms, how they are able to do it in a way which kind of makes sense. So how do you do it? In like, you know, how do you structure that kind of thing? I mean, I've not seen it live, but from the video, it looked like you're kind of at the center of it. And are you kind of directing to an extent, or like, how does it sort of work in practical terms?
Well, that's what everybody thinks, and that's what it looks like, but that's not what it is, you know?
Right.
The thing is, everybody who's joining in these jams are total professionals and experienced musicians, and have been improvising solo or in other formations for, you know, years or decades, you know. So everybody knows what it is to be in a room and have no plan and then just kind of steer things in a direction that makes sense, you know. So it's all based around trust. So I do have a mixer that kind of sums or merges the signals of everybody's setup. So basically everybody, every participant's setup has a stereo out coming into my sort of master mixer. Mm. And I do have the I do have the possibility to EQ or level or even throw on sort of individual effects on these channels, but I rarely do, to be honest, because if you start doing that, people, you know, you don't, I feel you don't really trust people, you know. If you give them the full responsibility of whatever they bring into the mix, then it's their fault when they fuck up. So, you know, but and that makes everybody more sort of on their feet and sort of focused and sharp, you know. Everybody, everybody is aware that whatever they do is straight in the mix, and there's no way back, if you know what I mean, you know. So it's yeah, it's, you have to be careful. And to be honest, with this, so with jamming with five people, because I basically have some of the signals and then I have my own setup, so it's five people jamming. Yeah, it's a matter of listening much more than doing, you know, because you know, you know, you're a producer, the actual elements that are needed or necessary to basically build an entire full spectrum of sonic, you know, material to sound good on a dance floor is actually very, very little. It's very small.
Yeah, sure.
You need some stuff in the bottom end, some in the mid range, and something on the top, and then you can even, you know, punch those things in and out, and that's basically three or four elements, and you're done. You know, so if you're there with five people, sometimes a person just plays like some percussion stuff for an hour, and then. You know, switches to some bass stuff. It's like, yeah, whatever is necessary. And basically people are just hanging around and listening and then seize their moment when they think, okay, this is the time. I've got something good going. Just I'll throw it in and see if it fits.
Yeah. And I suppose the obvious question, or the obvious thing to point out, I suppose, is the necessity for there to be as few egos as possible in this process, right? Because it's like you say, it's a process of, I guess it's the most important thing is knowing when not to play,
yeah.
Right? I suppose,
Yeah.
So how do you go about building the team, as it were? Because you've used that terminology, I think, in previous interviews here. You kind of look at it as a team kind of thing that you have to build. So how do you go about doing that?
Well, you know, it's a matter of putting people together who maybe already have some kind of history together, or, you know, at least know each other, or are you know. The thing is, though, I mean, that's just, it's just a bit of a direction, you know. I think about you know, what would be a nice combination with who, and it's just basically the whole thing is a complete gamble, man, to be honest. It's like
right.
Yeah, it's like everything is completely is a complete gamble up until the moment you're on stage with each other and diving into it. So I mean, you can try to imagine you know, some sort of dynamic between people in a team, but you can never really predict it, you know. So it's
sure.
I think the most important thing is to have a varied group, with each person being able to contribute something to the whole, you know, to the sum, and then it's just a matter of trust again, you know. That's pretty much it.
Yeah. What is your history of playing live in this kind of a way? Like, yeah, when did you first participate in such a performance?
Pretty much that's the first way I ever played, you know. That's not really true. I started as a hip hop DJ, so I played with vinyl, you know, two or three decks, you know, DJ style, the hip hop style. Mm. But then when that was sort of mid to late 80s, and then when house and techno happened, I started to incorporate, you know, drum machine to the setup, and so it's always been It's always been live, to be honest. And then when the setups got bigger, you know, with like a 16-channel desk and keyboards and shit, you know, having a car full of stuff to lug around. And the way of playing used to be having all these synths and drum machines split out over the mixer and then basically arrange everything there. Most of the stuff back then was sequenced, you know, sort of pre-programmed sequences, and then make combinations between the things that already were in the patterns that were already there. But these days with the store live, it's basically all completely improvised. So everything in my setup is running in step mode, and all the lines or all the programming and patterns are basically made on the fly. There's no presets, no memory. It's just modular synth and, you know, just start fucking around and hope for the best.
Yeah, totally. That's kind of what I was getting at. So like, I guess the development of music tech over this kind of period has gradually enabled that kind of approach. Is that fair? Or would it have been possible, had you wanted to, like back in the early 90s, to be able to do something like this in exactly the same kind of a way?
I don't know. Well, it happened to a certain extent because, building a setup is basically always an exercise of building something that gives you enough control to be able to be flexible on the spot and rigid enough to not fuck up, you know. So it's like it's a careful balance between something you know is always is reliable and something that gives you enough space to improvise, you know. So that's basically been my approach for you know all the times I've always played live. So even with all the setups and in the 90s and my setup now, I know I can always get something with the setup I have now, but what is going to happen, I don't know. But the actual amount of technological possibilities is limited. So it's just a very simple setup. It's like two synth voices, which each have their own sequencer, and one drum machine, which is split out all the individual instruments. They are going through the modular to be able to, you know, sort of play with the color of the sound and or distort them or, you know, put effects on them and stuff like that, or filters. And that gives me a palette that I can always find something that works very quickly, but it has enough flexibility to really sort of meander and venture off into corners or, you know, black holes and, you know, places where you never expected it to go. But so, yeah, it's a balance between those two. I think that's very important.
Right. Yeah, okay. And, you know, with like collaborating with this kind of setup, because I mean, for obviously five people is a lot to kind of fit into this kind of thing. So like in terms of how you develop this thing, and over time, the kind of classic, I suppose, electronic duo doing this kind of stuff. I mean, I've often said that one of the best things I've ever seen live was an Atom and Tobias improvised show, which was just awesome. So good. But I think, from what you're saying, and I can imagine, like, the more people that are doing it, the more difficult it is, I suppose, to get right. Is that a fair observation?
Yeah. There's more people who can fuck it up. Yeah. So.
right. Okay. That's the kind of main variable.
Yeah.
I
guess so. Yeah. Like I said, it's a gamble, but that's why the people that are invited, they have to have some kind of experience, you know. And but you know, the thing is, though, we do have like a Zoom call a few weeks or a week before the show, just to, you know, have this sort of personal conversation about what they can expect, or what just to kind of get a general vibe of how people gel, you know, personally. People make it more complicated in their heads. That's something that always occurs to me. They think it's more difficult than it actually is, because once they are on stage and they realize, oh, okay, I can just take it easy. There's 8 or 7 hours of this, you know, and I don't really have to make any kind of rush, or I don't have to feel impatient or I can just take it easy and just make my point whenever the occasion arises, rather than, you know, I have another half hour left and I haven't seen any hands in the air. You know what I mean? That's the usual. So everybody
that,
just...
Actually, sorry if I can just interrupt you. Yeah, that was the kind of question I was going to ask. Like, does doing it for longer paradoxically kind of make it easier?
Yeah, for sure.
Because
absolutely.
Because it's more relaxed.
Yeah. For sure. That's the... It would never be possible to do a show like this and have just 90 minutes. Because yeah, every time we do it, this was the fourth time last ADE, or the fifth if you count the pandemic Berlin one at Else. You know, every time the first 2 hours are kind of messy and just I wouldn't say real messy, but you can feel that people are feeling each other out, and there's still a bit of a rush feeling in the set, and then at some point, all these sort of nerves and all these expectations, they are completely off the table. You can just feel these moments sort of arriving when everybody thinks, okay, another 6 hours to go. I'm gonna, you know, do it a little bit easier. You know, I'm gonna just take it a notch back and just see what happens. And that's the moment when things start to gel and when things happen that feel completely natural and planned even sometimes, but they are not, you know, they're just happening.
Yeah, I suppose it must be quite freeing in a way, you know. And actually, when I was as I was listening to the ADE show from this year that I was this morning, like it really did occur to me that I mean, I suppose it's almost like an all-night DJ set, but obviously having the kind of addition of, you know, multiple people involved, it just, I guess, it frees it even further. I mean, in terms of like the musical structure, to what extent is that, I mean, I think you're going to say not very much this, but like, to what extent is there any sort of planning in terms of like what kind of thing it's going to be, if you see what I mean?
Well, if you don't watch the entire sets, then you get the idea that it's all pretty much banging stuff, right? But if you listen to the whole thing, you can see it. There's quite a lot of variation going on in tempo and styles and stuff. And that's basically also the I wouldn't say the wish, how do you say that, like the question that people ask me when I invite them is because usually they've seen only the, you know, like highlights, or like maybe they skimmed through the whole 7 hours and they've seen the bigger moments, and they ask, well, is there any room to maybe start ambient for the first hour, or, you know, just without beats or whatever you would call it, you know, just and maybe do some dubby sections, or maybe just really fast sections, like go into sort of drum and bass territory. And I'm like, yeah, absolutely. You know, this is definitely, you know, it makes it way more interesting if everybody is on that same thought, you know. So the thing is, though, yeah, there's a few technical restrictions, because okay, so I got this sort of end of the line mixer, and I also control I basically do the shaping of the dynamics, you know. So I have the DJ role, so I use the filter and cut the bass and, you know, make rises and stuff, and that's sort of my part. I haven't tried a setup where we might sort of rotate that role. It would actually mean to for some person to actually take my place, you know, physically. Maybe we'll do that in the future, but could be done. But I wouldn't say that I'm always the one doing the drops or the you know, changing the thing, the dynamics of the set, because sometimes I just consciously leave the bass with just one person until they understand, okay, it's my turn, because it's all non-verbal, right? So things might just go on for without anything going on in the bottom end for about 2 minutes, and then some person might realize, okay, if nobody's doing it, I'm doing it, you know.
I'll do it.
So, but yeah, and the other thing is that I have this master clock that feeds the sync signals to everybody's setup. So I can change the tempo. I can actually half the tempo or double it or swing the tempo even. You know, I use the master clock because, first of all, it's possible to reset individual setups because it is a four-channel clock. So if somebody starts to run out, I don't have to restart the whole thing, but I can just restart an individual setup. And sometimes people come over to me and do it themselves. So that's another sort of overall thing that is controlled from my station. So if the tempo is going faster, it's either when somebody shouts in my ear, can we increase the tempo, you know, or it's myself just doing something with the tempo to sort of put people off and force them to do something else, you know. So there is sort of that like a direction coming from me, but again, also, you know, when I'm on a break, because everybody takes breaks, you know, like half an hour to, I don't know, have a toilet break or whatever, people do come over to my spot and fuck around with the tempo. So yeah, it's not, right. There's no rules, you know, it's basically, yeah, what happens, happens. And yeah.
Sure. So when it goes wrong, what is it that goes wrong generally?
Well, technically things that can go wrong are things running out of sync, but that's an easy fix.
Sure.
Too many people sort of thinking they're pre-listening, sort of writing a melody line or a bass line, and they're actually in the mix, you know, so they're basically just, you know, putting in random notes and everybody hears the blip, 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 you know, just completely dissonant and unplanned. That's something that goes wrong sometimes. And other than that, what's wrong, you know? I mean, it's live, it's improvised, anything can happen. So people in the room know what's going on, and the musicians as well. So everybody kind of embraces those mistakes, you know? It's like, that's what happens. If you put five people together and they have no plan, you know, things can go amazing, but things can also go wrong. And that's the whole, I think that's the element that puts the audience on their feet as well, you know, there is some kind of willingness from the audience to join that sort of unknown path to whatever is next, you know.
Yeah,
improvising as an improviser, as a musician, when you're on stage in these conditions, you are basically as much a spectator to the whole thing as the audience is a spectator, because nobody knows what's going to happen even the next second, you know what I mean?
Right.
It's everything is unfolding while you're there, so it's a very much a here and now thing. It's like you're in the moment with everybody in the room, and if something goes wrong, everybody hears that, but people don't mind because it's just another thing that happens on the road. But things will sort of glue again after some time. People accept that, you know. So it's I don't see them really as mistakes, you know what I mean? It's part of the format, part of the way of doing this.
Yeah, I guess part of the trick to it must be sort of identifying when something doesn't work and then moving on from that quickly, and then when the cool things do happen, knowing which to develop and, you know, which bits to emphasize and all that kind of stuff. Is that fair?
Yeah, and most things that are sort of kept under control are level things, for example, you know, somebody's synth might, you know, if some synths, you know, they are quite stable in level whenever, whatever you do with the sound. Some synths, they become fucking 20 dB louder when you put the filter open, you know, something like that. So that's something that, right, that all of us are kind of trying to keep under control. So I must say that to completely describe what's going on, it's also the fact that we are in the middle of the room. You know, it's a whole different setup than being on stage and having this distance to an audience. Basically, we're in the middle of the room, everybody's around it, and the setup is basically, and the people that are playing are on, they're just 1.5 meters away and on eye level, you know, so it's, we're just raised maybe, I don't know, 50 centimeters above the crowd. So it's very, very close, and it feels like, in rock music, you used to have these unplugged sessions on MTV, and you know, these really intimate audience around it, not too many people being very close and almost touchable, you know what I mean? Like, this is a whole different relationship to the crowd. And and then it's also because everybody is standing around it and are on different levels, this sort of like this bathtub around you of people and faces. And normally when you're on stage, only the first row of people have uninterrupted view on the people who are playing, and everybody else in the room is watching someone's back, you know?
Everybody on top of someone's head, right?
Yeah. So it's, everybody's facing the same way. But if you're in a circle, the only thing you see in front of you is other people's faces, and that makes such a big difference. It makes it very theatrical. It makes it very, very sort of this unity feeling and this common experience is very much enhanced because of the setup. And then there's the video people, the VJs. They work along a similar setup as I do with the musicians. So there's one person kind of deciding what signals are coming, are being displayed on the big monolith video wall above the performers. And they work with several sort of, you know, VJs or video artists who are generating live video and basically VJing and then sort of jamming together on whatever is going on in the music, and then the whole thing forms this total experience where the lights, the video, you know, the music is just all trying to complement each other and create this going from sort of scene to scene, you know, in on the night. So yeah, it's definitely a live show plus, you know. It's like it's also the experience of the setup and the way the people are placed in the room and everything that makes it, I guess, a bit different than a DJ night and with everybody looking the same, everybody looking one direction, you know.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Sure, absolutely. I mean, it sounds fucking awesome, to be honest. I really want to go to one of these now. But I mean, it also sounds like a pretty good antidote to quite a lot of what has become, the last few years of what has become popular in techno, or certain aspects of techno anyway. Was that a conscious thing at all for you?
No, I don't feel I don't feel responsible for the scene. I'm quite, you know, I've never really felt attached to my position within the whatever other people are doing. But I think the approach is a bit more timeless. And depends on much longer arcs and longer concentration spans than some of the other stuff that's going on, for sure. Yeah, but it's not to prove a point. It's just because that's what I like.
Right, that's a diplomatic way of putting it.
No, that's really how I feel about it.
Yeah, fair enough, man. Totally. So it sort of reminds me of it's a general approach. I mean, I always talk about going to Labyrinth Festival and how much fun I've had there, and with a kind of similar, I guess, overall approach to things. And that's where I saw the Atom and Tobias set, actually, which was just like I said, incredible. But yeah, I mean, I do think it's a sort of organic, if I can use that word. I'm not sure if it's quite the right word to use, but it feels like a more organic approach to, you know, what is, I think, at its heart, kind of improvisational music, techno. I mean, do you think that's true? Is it a kind of improvisational art form generally?
Well, I mean, there are many approaches, you know. There are the approaches where you rely on pre-recorded stuff, like other people's records, or you can. There's this whole spectrum of ways to go about it, you know. You can play vinyl and play tracks from start to finish and be really good at it, and transfer your ideas or, you know, sort of make an impression on people and create a vibe using just that. That's you know, some people are masterful in doing that. That's one end of the spectrum, and the other one is completely improvised, and there's all these variations and forms in between, from, you know, using two decks or four decks, or, you know, having hybrid setups with drum machines, or, you know, digital whatever, you know, you name it. There's all kinds of ways to go about it, and to be honest, I'm not so, you know, it's I'm not so purist or any or I don't have an opinion on how people do what they do, what tools they choose to do it, but I'm more you know, concerned, or I'm more interested in what they convey, you know, what is the, well, you know, I want to hear their voice, you know, their take on things, and
yeah,
I don't know, you know, it's something that doesn't really
I hear you, man.
Interest me. If you're a good DJ using CDJ, it's fine. If you use a laptop, fine. You know, whatever. It's I mean, there's a difference in the visual thing. I understand that when a person is on stage with a laptop, that the perception is, well, the computer must be doing all that stuff. You know,
right?
But who cares? I don't care. I mean, I know how it works. I know that you can be very risky and put your balls on the table with something that lives in the computer and is completely, totally risky and unsafe, and still, you know, people will say, yeah, it must be pre-recorded or whatever. You know what I mean? I don't care, whatever.
I mean, it's what comes out of the speakers that counts, right?
Yeah. Is everybody having a good time? And do you like what you see or hear? You know, is that, that's the main thing, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely.
Can an artist you know, find a way to really interest or get the interest of people, and I'm looking for the word. What is it like? Can you hold a room together for a long time? You know, can you actually
the attention? Yeah,
yeah. Yeah. Can you continuously have the people's attention? That's the main thing, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. And as you said, there's almost an infinite number of ways to get there. Right. And
yeah,
who cares? As long as you arrive at the destination, then that's the most important thing. Right.
Yeah.
So, okay. I wanted to talk about the Ginger Records, of course, because it's the 30th anniversary of it. And well, I mean, this is my first experience of hearing your music. I have to say, I smoked a lot of weeds to this album as a teenager. I really did. So just before we got on this call, I was reading an interview of yours from 1997, actually, which is online for some reason.
Okay.
Yeah, it was super interesting, actually. But I mean, obviously, that's a few years after Ginger came out. But can you just describe the techno scene that the Artificial Intelligence series was coming into? Because, you know, obviously Ginger was part of that Warp Record series, and lots of different versions of the story have been told over time, but it was, I think, generally speaking, supposed to be a sort of home, quote unquote, home listening techno series kind of thing. So can you describe what the techno scene was like in 1992, 1993?
Okay, well, it's hard to explain for everybody who hasn't lived that time, but that was before the internet, you know? So that's yeah. That's the first thing. So it's a whole different scene, basically, and it was the it was just basically just after the electronic dance music became happened, you know. It was like the late 80s, early 90s was when it all happened, and there's a few things that sort of happened together, you know. The wall came down, you know, you had this new drug, blah blah blah, and all this new music, and that sort of caused a sort of new youth culture, if you want, and it was basically
can I just interrupt you there? You mentioned before that you've been a hip hop DJ during the 80s, right? So what was your experience of this?
Well, you know, I was dabbling in all kinds of stuff, you know. So is hip hop DJ? Yeah, I had decks, you know, and I was pretty fast on them. So I did all these DJ battles that were happening in the mid 80s. There were some radio stations organizing those, and I participated, and, you know, sort of caught some got in that scene basically. And but as soon as I used to hang around record shops, you know, that's where you got your information. So there was no internet, so where do you go for information to find out about new music? Record shops, you know, and so maybe magazines, read reviews or whatever, or you know, having mixtapes from friends or whatever, or going to clubs. But yeah, so in these record shops, that's the first time I heard you know, the early sort of first acid house coming through and stuff from the Chicago and New York, and I was immediately completely blown away and fascinated, and it sounded like something that I could do myself, you know. It sounded very simple, and let's be honest,
had you learned instruments as a kid or stuff like that? What was your sort of musical background?
Turntables, that's if you would count that towards learning an instrument. That was fucking practicing every day, to finish, you know. So it's sort of the same thing, but not traditional, I guess. And I had a tape machine, and I used to do these tape cutting mixes, you know. There were some of these underground bootleg tape labels, and I used to contribute mixes for that, you know, on my Revox, you know, just cutting, slicing tape and all that stuff. And I used to also start doing, you know, with the tape machine, you could do loops, obviously, you know. So make repetitive stuff during making sort of repetitive stuff using tape loops, and then sort of overdub them on a cassette and then play them back again, add something to it, you know, all that sort of.
Yeah.
You know.
That's the real shit right there, man. Fuck. So was that with a 4-track?
No, it was just 2. And then bouncing between 2 decks, yeah.
Got it. Yeah, okay.
Hell of a lot of work.
Yeah, right. Absolutely. How do you learn how to do that?
Just being in record shops and running into people who also had tape decks and were doing these mixes just going by and, you know, visit them at their little studio or their house and see how it's done, and then, you know, go back to your own room and do it yourself, you know, kind of thing.
Trial and error, yeah.
Yeah, first exactly.
Sounds terrible, and then you get good at it, I guess, like anything.
Yeah, it's just it's a hell of a lot of work to get very small results. So you do learn how to make early decisions, you know. So it's something. I mean, if you have an open system which has endless possibilities forever and ever and ever, you run the risk of never making any decisions because you can always change something. But if you have to stick to it, commit to something very early on, you think more, you learn to think more result-based, you know, like, this is my idea, this is where I want to get, let's make it happen. And then it's just building a castle, you know. It's like you have to get all these stones ready and sort of build them brick by brick, and at some point you're there.
Yeah, it's fascinating, it really is. Like, because having to commit in that kind of a way is just not something that you really need to do in the studio these days at all. Like, I mean,
that's right. But yeah, I mean, the danger is there that you don't, but you can definitely create circumstances where you are forced to have to do that, you know?
Yeah, you can build it in, yeah.
Yeah. So yeah. So you basically say, okay, this is the gear for today. Just this drum machine, this synth, or just make it yourself very, very difficult, and just use a mixing desk with no inputs. You know, I don't know. There's all kinds of way.
Sure, of course. But I mean, it's almost counterintuitive that would be useful. I'm just thinking about for kids starting now. You know, like it's not necessarily something you would expect to say, I've got to impose these restrictions upon myself. You know,
to be honest, I think the most interesting things happen really on the edges of what's possible. You know, like that's where the surprises and the fulfillment comes from. If you can make something happen with very little, the return you get, the feeling you get, or the satisfaction you get from being able to do something with so little is much bigger than, you know, it's just sort of mousing around and, you know, stacking plugin after plugin until you I don't know.
Yeah, absolutely. I completely agree with you. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I mean, I started making music not because it's... I have to make tracks. I started making music because I think the process is interesting, and I love to be I love to, you know, challenge myself and see what I can come up with, you know. And yeah, that's just much more satisfying to me than sort of Lego a track together.
Yeah, yeah, that's a good way of putting it, actually. Yeah. Anyway, sorry, I interrupted you. You were talking about getting into making tracks in the first place.
I forgot what I was talking about. Sorry about
that. Yeah, so my original question was about the techno scene in 92. But you were in the middle of telling me how you got into DJing, coming out of acid house and that kind of stuff. So I just thought of a question though. What was your first rave that you went to?
I don't even remember. I we're talking about 30 years ago, man. This is a long time ago.
I
didn't keep any calendars on what happened when, but...
Yeah, okay. Well, what's the first, important experience in your head?
Well, the first time I walked into a warehouse and there was just a fucking shitload of smoke and a strobe and really mechanical, insanely loud music that was very mechanical and sounded completely alien to me. That's basically the whole picture, you know, like, and to be honest, if you look at the Store Live thing now, or even sort of the audiovisual signature, or for example, an Aphex Twin live show, that's still sort of glorified early rave culture, you know, with bleepy stuff and sort of strobing visuals. And that's basically all, the same thing with new technology. To be honest, we're still doing nothing new and still.
it's just keeping
that thing alive. Now, not keeping that thing alive is the wrong way to say it, but just it definitely made a big impression because it was so different from anything else that was there, and it was also, I wouldn't say secretive, but it had this kind of. This is us against, this is just for us kind of feeling vibe, you know, because it was not on the radio. Nobody was playing it on the radio or let alone any other, you know, like TV or whatever. It was just a complete, a culture that was for and from the people that were involved in it, you know. And
Like a real underground culture in a way.
And everybody, even the people who came to dance, you know, they'd made much more effort to dress up, and you know, they were as much the participant and the in the whole thing. Then there was less distinction between audience and performers. Even in the beginning, some people you didn't even know there was a DJ, you know. There was some, they were tucked away somewhere in the on the side of the room, you know. There was not dancing with everybody face to the DJ. There was people just sort of jumping around the room without, they were just having a party with each other rather than coming to see a DJ, you know.
Yeah.
Anyway, I really don't like talking about the past too much, you know, because you run the risk that it becomes sort of... glorified as something that is legendary or whatever, but it was just us, you know, people like who were in there, who stumbled upon this thing. They were just very unaware that it would ever become something, that it would ever outlive a few years, you know what I mean. It was just completely amateurist and without any expectation. So nobody knew what they were doing. It was just there.
Totally, yeah. And I'm sorry, but I am going to have to ask you about the past, because we've got to talk about this album, and unfortunately it's quite a long time ago.
Yeah.
So, I mean, how did it come about that you made this record that got signed to Warp? Like, did you get signed and then made the record, or was it the other way around? Like, how did it work?
Yeah, well, in those days, it was very common. You would send tapes to all kinds of labels and then have things released under different names. So I was in touch with a bunch of labels, and I think the one that got me in the public eye was probably when I started releasing stuff on Plus 8.
Yeah,
John Acquaviva was running that at the time, and Richie Horton was his sort of partner in doing that, and they were same age, you know. We were probably 19, 20, 21 when we got in touch, like right at the beginning. And so I sent them a bunch of cassette tapes, and I had like dozens of tracks on there, and they they said, well, there's at least two or three EPs in there. Let's go, you know. So I flew over there.
Nice.
Yeah, so I flew over there and
right, because they're in Detroit at this point, right, still?
Yeah, in Windsor, in Canada, just across the river.
Yeah.
So we were just basically, you know, sort of in the very early stages of our careers, I guess, and they had a label, and there was at the time already this sort of mythical thing around Detroit, you know, about the, you know, around the early releases, the underground resistance stuff, Derek May and KMS, you know, all that stuff, Metroplex. So it already had this sort of stature or I don't know, attraction.
Yeah, kind of aura.
Yeah, absolutely.
Was that the first time you'd been to the States?
First time ever in an airplane, man.
Really? Wow. Okay.
Yeah, it is 1990. Yeah, yeah. So I signed to Plus 8, and they at the same time Warp was in their early stages. I think they had like 8 or 9 releases out before they had this idea that. You know, all these people who were doing 12 inches used, you know, okay, so let me start over. People were releasing stuff on 12 inch. That was the norm, you know. So you would send a tape to a label. They would say, okay, this is the A side. You can do something freaky on the B side. All fine, you know, we just want that banging track and then we'll do a release. And so B sides or B2 sides were usually the place where you would stick your sort of more experimental thing or your sort of more home listening thing or your weird track, you know. And Rob Mitchell at the time of Warp, he noticed that, you know, he noticed, well, these people making music, very functional stuff for dance floors, but they can also do that. What they also do is do sort of these chilled out, dubby, you know, sort of listening versions of that music. Let's do an album, because, you know how early rave culture was like, you know, you had this party and then you would go to some person's house and hang around and spend the whole morning sort of spacing out on what, you know, sort of trippy music. And I think the thought was, let's do an album series that is that sort of portrays this music as an actual serious genre, you know, rather than just stuff that makes people jump, but also these musicians also need a platform as musicians. I think that was the intention. So they basically asked a bunch of people. So they asked Richie, they asked me, they asked obviously the people who stuck to Warp on, you know, Ortega, Aphex, all these people. Okay, we're going to do this album series, and nobody was doing albums. So we were basically presented with this canvas, you know, like the, what would you do if you had the 70 minutes of space to do your thing, you know, and it doesn't need to be dance floor oriented. You can just do whatever the hell you like and people can play it at home. It will be on CD, blah, blah, blah. Well, that basically made everybody think, I guess, or at least it made me think, what can I do with this format? You know, what are the possibilities and challenges for this format? So I took the approach to make everything way more sort of pleasant sounding and soft and melodic and sort of spacey. And because if you don't have the, you know, if you don't have the necessity to make it really, really punchy for, you know, like a club mix and something that sticks to vinyl, if you can just do whatever you want and sonically, then, you know, that was my idea behind the album, you know, do something which has its roots in the dance floor, but still has an angle to it which makes it easier to digest when you're listening to it at home.
I mean, I'm just looking at the list of albums now in the series, and it's crazy because they're all so good. The Polygon Window album, the Black Dog, B12, Fuse, your album, and the first Ortega album. I mean, yeah, it's a really incredible body of work that you guys collectively came up with. So, and it actually makes complete sense, you know, when you describe it like that, because it's a fairly common approach, I think, that was taken, but they all sound, yeah, they all sound like the, well, unsurprisingly, like the artist involved, but like, you know, I mean, it really, it's a really noticeable kind of like individual take on the same kind of idea. It's just, yeah, it's amazing. So how long did it take you to make it, roughly? Do you remember?
No, but I don't think it was very long. Because I was basically making music every day, you know, and I would say, I don't know, it's maybe 3-4 months, something like that.
Yeah. And do you remember what your studio setup was like over time?
Yeah, it was basically, you know, the classics, you know, like the stuff that everybody was using, like 909, 303, 808, like the Roland series, and then Juno 106, some sample. I think I had a 950, an S950 Akai. Main drum machine was the R8, because I used to also use that as a sequencer, so to trigger one-shot samples. And mixing desk, bunch of effects, you know, just the old school 16 channel or 24 channel. I don't even remember how many channels, but just have all these instruments coming out to the desk, split them there, and then just use the desk as sort of like an instrument, because I think most of the tracks, in exception of a few, are live takes as well.
Right.
So they're basically just running, sequences running, and then press start, and then just sort of arrange it by hand, you know, just punching stuff in and out.
Yeah, wow. Awesome. Would that have been the same studio that you were talking about in that interview from 97 that I read today, which was the top floor of a flat that you were living in Rotterdam?
No.
Okay, that was before.
It was before that. And the one that was in that interview, that's the place where I recorded the stuff when I was on Novamute.
Right.
So the Public Energy #1 album and Shocking Hobby, that was all recorded there.
Yeah, okay. No, it's funny actually, because, yeah, the subsequent albums that you made in the 90s, they kind of get more... but progressively more experimental and progressively more, I guess, what's the word? Not hard, but like, I mean, I guess they're less easy listening, if you know what I mean. They're less kind of like, as you describe, like, you know, stick something on when you get home from a rave that's going to be kind of like nice and pleasant. And actually, it's sort of similar to the other artists that contributed to the Artificial Intelligence series. I'm thinking particularly of Ortega. Like, as the 90s went on, the music became gradually more experimental, I guess. So, I mean, can you comment on that?
I don't know. First of all, experimental has never been the goal, you know. I've never said to myself, let's do an experimental album, you know, because
Right. The
whole process is an experiment. So it's whatever I do, whether it's whether the outcome is easy to digest than the sort of harder stuff or the more less accessible stuff, the process is always trial and error. So in a sense, everything that I've ever done is experimental.
Yeah, sure.
But I don't know. Yeah, every now and then I just get bored with whatever I'm doing, and then I'll try to go down another avenue, you know, different thing.
Mm. But I can completely relate to that. Absolutely.
Yeah, the thing is, if you always do the same thing, what is there to explore, you know? So it's there's things you repeat, of course, because you know it works, but I always need something to explore, you know. I always need some kind of challenge to be able to come up with something interesting, because if that element is not in there in the process, then I just lose my focus and my interest. I'm very much working more from aesthetics. I have like an aesthetic in my mind, and I try to capture that, and then whether it's danceable or whether it's has more sort of unusual rhythms or no rhythms at all, you know, that's secondary. I'm sort of, you know, steering things towards a sonic signature rather than anything else.
Yeah, that makes sense. It absolutely makes sense. So the next question I had was, like, the term IDM basically came out of the Artificial Intelligence series. And obviously IDM is something it's a term that people, generally speaking, don't like very much. But
you mean
to what extent
IDM
intelligent dance music.
Yeah.
Like, to what extent did you feel like you were part of something, like a genre, at that point, you know, coming out of that kind of series? Because I think, like, obviously it was very successful, and it spawned a lot of, like I said, it was a defined genre that really came out of that. And obviously there were other releases that defined it too. But I mean, to what extent did you feel like you were part of that thing?
Well, and nobody sets out to create a genre, you know.
Yeah.
And nobody is aware that it's happening. It's only afterwards that you realize, okay, this was a sign of the times thing, and then it gets sort of recognized as something that happened in a certain part of music history or whatever. But so at the time, I've never had the idea that I was part of something. Maybe in hindsight, you could say that, it was sort of categorized to be part of it, but that's something that is not coming from me. That is just the perception of how people see it in the context of everything else that was going on.
So you didn't, at that point, or at any point during the 90s, feel like there was a kind of gang of...
No, I wasn't on a mission. Hey, let's create a genre and let's...
I didn't necessarily mean that, create it. But like, you know, these things kind of, they emerge and then suddenly, well, I mean, I certainly know from my experiences in, for example, in bass music stuff, even if it's not an intention, like when something catches the imagination of the audience, okay, like that.
Yeah, in that sense, you could say... You feel that something gets momentum, that it's sort of that you're right. I mean, that in that sense, it might have influenced certain decisions, or you know. But at the same time, I've always also done things that completely fell dead, you know, and there was nobody was thinking about that, nobody was interested in that idea, or So. I'm not very good in career planning in that sense.
Some
things just die, you know, and in the studio, and they're not part of anything, and they're not remembered, and then at some other, you know, during some other project, you kind of cross paths with some movement, and all of a sudden you're part of it, you know, and then but it's not always on purpose, in my case anyway.
Yeah, totally. So, I mean, how about techno then? Because, I mean, obviously you're very much associated with techno as a genre now. How do you think about it in your own head, if you do at all? Because, I mean, we've discussed techno in this conversation already, but how do you feel about your relationship with it? Like, do you feel any kind of involvement or even kind of ownership over it, you know? I mean, how do you feel about your relationship with it?
Yeah, I mean, it's called techno, but I'm not... certainly no ownership, and also maybe not any responsibility. It's just that's what it ended up being called, you know, because in the early days, this music would have been called house, or at least in the places where I hung out, you know, it was techno was something that was strictly from Detroit, and everything else was house. Yeah, they were called house parties, you know. So in the beginning, I thought I was doing house stuff, but now it's been, with hindsight, it's been called techno. So yeah, I don't care, man. I don't. It's just that I know I'm in techno lineups. I'm you know, making my money with playing out as a techno DJ lots of the times. I don't feel any responsibility or even connection. I just like the energy of the, and the tempo and the sort of stylistic elements of techno more than most of the other dance floor styles, I guess. I have more connection with that audience than other styles, and I like the environments better. I usually like the lights and visuals better, or the darkness even, you know, the lack of lights and visuals. It has a sort of like this chance of being sort of half anonymous.
Right. Yeah. Okay.
It has a certain element of anonymity in there, so I feel comfortable in that environment, and I've learned how to manipulate the energy of rooms, and it's not like a trick or anything, but I find that I have a grip on that, you know. Yeah, and that's pretty much why I do it, you know. It's something that comes natural now after all these years. It's something that I've learned how to do, and it's in my skill set, and I enjoy it. I love it. So that's that's how I see my place, you know?
Yeah, absolutely, man. Well, listen, this has been fun. Really, really enjoyed chatting to you. Thanks for your time today, mate. It's great.
Yeah, thanks for having me, man. Enjoyed it. Thanks.
Yeah, that was Speedy J. You may have gathered that I geeked out slightly during that conversation, or at least my 14 to 17 year old self was geeking out subconsciously. Because as I mentioned in the conversation, I listened to the whole series of artificial intelligence a lot. And I think to this day, it's just amazing music. So yeah, go and listen to that album. Go and listen to the other albums in the series if you haven't done so already. Or if you, even if you have listened to them, go back and listen to them again, because they're absolutely fucking awesome. Really, really awesome. Anyway, great chat this week. Slightly shorter than usual, but that's okay. If you're enjoying the show, then we'd love to have your direct support. That would really, really help us if you decided to support us direct. You can do that on Patreon, patreon.com/scubaofficial, or through a one-off donation on scubaofficial.io/support. That would be an extremely nice thing for you to do. But you also do get bonus stuff as a result of your support. So yeah, particularly on Patreon, jet over there and check it out. Okay, if you don't want to do that, then follow the show. Wherever you listen to this podcast, hit the follow button, hit the 5-star button on the reviews, leave us a review as well if you so desire. That'd be nice. And follow the Spotify playlist. Link in the show notes to that playlist. Oh, and also, yeah, jump up in the Discord if you've got anything to say. We'd love to have you there. hotflushrecordings.com/discord. Okay, I'm out. I will see you back here same time, same place next week on the next episode of the Not a Diving Podcast. Thank you.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style. Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.